Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comics podcast at AIPTcomics.com. My name is David Brook. This is the 38th episode. And guess what? I have a co-host guest with me today, Chris Hassan. And this is his second AIPT Comics Podcast. So welcome aboard, Chris.
Hello, everybody. Great to be here, Dave.
Yeah, I'm really happy to have you on because there's some interesting X-Men news to talk about. But before we get there, I just want to let everyone know we have special guest Daniel Kibblesmith on. Ooh. He's currently writing Loki at Marvel Comics. You might know him from many other works, some at Valiant, some at DC. He's been all over the place. And he's also a writer at Late Night with Stephen Colbert, which is pretty cool.
Very cool.
He'll be on later in the show, so just hang with us, because this is the show where we talk about the latest news of the week. We recap the last week of comics by picking our two favorite comics, and then we look ahead to the comics coming out next Wednesday by picking our favorite cover art and talking about the book that we're most looking forward to.
That's a mouthful, Dave.
So much.
Can I ask you a question, Dave, before we get underway?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
How does my voice sound? How does the microphone sound?
The microphone sounds great.
So guess what, listeners? Dave didn't think my microphone sounded good enough last time, and I was sick all week. So what he did was he went to Amazon.com.
I hope so.
All right. So he went to Amazon.com and ordered me a microphone because I couldn't get out and get a microphone. That's the kind of co-host Dave is, everybody.
That's, yeah, and out of my own pocket, I paid for that.
I owe you some pizza.
So that's a guarantee that he'll be on the show again, because he better work. He's got to work for it. He's got to work for that.
Is that why you did that?
I just locked you in for at least six more episodes.
All righty. So speaking of into the news,
yes. So top of the news this week, we're going to talk about Powers of X number 4, which just came out a few days ago, and it has a lot of people talking because of a certain sinister villain, Mr. Sinister, that is. And in the issue, there are sinister secrets.
Yes.
And I don't. How many are there? Do you remember? There's like seven, right?
No, there's about like 12 or 13.
Oh my god!
I don't remember.
So many.
I don't have a book in front of me, but there were a lot.
It's a tantalizing list because, you know, Jonathan Hickman, who's the writer of the comic, basically listed out all these tantalizing ideas that could be further explored. And what's extra fascinating about that is Kieran Gillen tweeted out, "Do kind of want to see if I can talk Marvel into letting me launch Mr. Sinister's massive secrets." And Jonathan Hickman tweet replied back at him saying, you know, that he would love to have him on, basically. And that he's proud to bring in another scribe. But what's funny about this is Kieran Gillen famously wrote X-Men for quite a bit. And in his first main story arc on the book, Mr. Sinister was the villain.
Yeah, I think Sinister was throughout the whole run there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he really left a stamp on Sinister. I think a lot of fans, X-fans, really loved that run. It was short, but... And I know Jordan White, the X-Men senior editor, who... I do X-Men Monday with every week at APT. He's a big fan of that run too. And I think Jordan replied in that thread too on Twitter. So I wouldn't be surprised if this could happen. But I know that you at San Diego Comic-Con this year, you talked to Kieran Gillen, right?
I did. I asked him a couple questions for your X-Men Monday column. Mm-hmm. Because you're the curator of that, and you're also the keeper of questions.
Because my own sinister secrets.
If you're listening, dear listeners, X-Men Monday comes out every Monday, and Chris actually basically manages the whole thing, right? And you basically pull together questions from Twitter fans who are asking questions online, and then you pose those to Jordan, who then answers those, and then you get to put all that together and put your little spin on it, which you do a wonderful job with.
Thank you. And the preview art.
And there's preview art, yep. And actually, this upcoming Monday, there's some pretty sweet preview art in there.
Oh, yeah.
And answers, too.
Yeah, this week we're doing a new X-Men. It's kind of like an X-Men Monday book club, because obviously Jordan had nothing to do with Grant Morrison's run, but he recently reread it on vacation. So I thought it's kind of fun. All of us get to geek out together over new X-Men.
And the next X-Men Monday after that, can you have him answer all the Sinister Secrets questions?
Yeah, I'll do that.
Spoilers, please. Were there any Sinister Secrets that struck you as particularly interesting?
I think the one that's getting people excited is, of course, relating to X-Romance. I think it alludes to some kind of affair or something, but I've seen a lot of people online saying it's about the love square or love quadrangle, whatever, between Emma Frost, Cyclops, Jean Grey, and Wolverine. And it's kind of alluding to a different approach to love on the Mutant Island. So I saw a lot of people talking about orgies.
Of course they are.
Polyamorous love. But it's funny because people have kind of been digging and going back. And Jonathan Hickman tweeted a couple months ago that a group of mutants is known as an orgy. So
Yeah, I saw that. Yep.
Yeah. And also Jordan mentioned that too in a former X-Men Monday that that I shared on Twitter. That he mentioned Jonathan is more interested in redefining what X-Men romance is. So we'll see. We'll see how progressive the X-Men romance gets.
We recommend checking out Powers of X number 4 just to see those sinister secrets because there are a couple interesting ones in there. I'm sure that a couple of them are just jokes too, though. I mean, just throw away.
If you look at the top of the page, they have the Hickman text. It says lies. So
Right. So in our next bit of news, we've been talking, actually last week we talked about Tom Taylor potentially taking over Suicide Squad, and lo and behold, the DC solicits came out, and yep, Tom Taylor is in fact writing Suicide Squad number 1 in December, and he's going to be matched with Bruno Redondo, which is pretty sweet. He's a very slick artist, and yeah, so I just wanted to bring that up because we were right on this show. If you listened to the show, you already knew this information before it was revealed. So this is the time of month where we start to get the solicits for December, and Marvel also released their solicit information, and there's some really tantalizing stuff in there. They haven't actually released their entire solicits, by the way, just a couple of them. And one of the biggest ones was their new Incoming series, which is it's called Incoming Number 1. It's written by a ton of writers, probably Marvel's best writers, including Al Ewing, Dan Slott, Chip Zdarsky, Kelly Thompson, Greg Pak, Teeny Howard, et cetera, et cetera. So many
Jonathan
folks.
Hickman.
It's insane. I don't know. They must be writing like vignettes, or maybe it's a whole collaboration thing. We'll find out, I suppose. But they've been hyping this for a couple weeks or days. No, just about a week and a half now. And we talked about it on the podcast last week, these promo images. But the whole thing is hyping this murder mystery. And it's asking readers to solve it before the heroes do. And so we got a little more information about that. Are you interested in this series at all, Chris?
Well, I'm a bit I'm a bit tired of events.
Yes.
But I saw the X-Men in it, so I obviously have to read it.
Right.
And at first, I was like, I don't know about this, but then I saw Hickman's involved. So I'm like, okay. Because, you know, obviously Hickman's doing something very elaborate, and I wouldn't want anyone to do something on the side that interferes with that. But if he's put his stamp on it, I think we'll be okay.
I did see fans were excited because the mutants haven't typically been involved in events lately.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, we don't know how House of X and Powers of X end yet, but it'll be interesting to see where things land and how they're reintegrated into the Marvel Universe.
Right. Do you have any hot takes on who's murdered? Who's the big murdery? It's Xavier, isn't it?
I'm looking at the art here, and it's a arm, it's a hand dripping blood.
Yes.
And they're all looking up at the person.
So I love how shocked Venom looks. The guy's
why is he even there?
He's like eating brains, and yet he's like, why?
Spider-Man is really losing his mind.
He is. Maybe it's Aunt May.
I'm gonna say it's someone from the Suicide Squad.
Perfect. Also coming out is Doctor Strange by Mark Waid. This one's particularly interesting because in the issue that came out either this week or last week, I forget now, basically Doctor Strange's hands have been fixed, healed. So now he can actually go back to being a surgeon. And based on the cover art by Phil Noto, who you actually interviewed a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, we met him a couple weeks ago, both of us. Oh, yeah. We talked to him.
We did.
We're just name dropping left and right here.
It's particularly interesting because he's had these hands that can't do surgery for decades now. So it's a big change for him. There's also a Cosmic Ghost Rider book that Dennis Hopeless Hallam, who's been on this podcast before, he is co-writing that with Donny Cates. He actually was hyping that on Twitter recently about how they were working together on something. Cates is also finishing off Guardians of the Galaxy. What's particularly interesting to me is that Spider-Ham is coming out, a new Spider-Ham series, but it's written by Zeb Wells, who hasn't, I don't think, written comics in a while.
Yeah, I don't know when I last saw him. I remember reading his Peter Parker Spider-Man back in the day in the early 2000s. Yeah, I remember, I enjoyed that. I think it was inevitable, the Peter Parker return. So
yeah, I'm wondering if this is a sign that they will release a Spider-Ham animated movie before we ever anticipated.
It's called Apocalypse Now. I just saw that, so props.
Okay, so moving away from Marvel, Image Comics revealed, and also Scott Snyder and Charles Soule revealed, that their upcoming book coming out in November, Undiscovered Country, is actually getting optioned. We don't know yet if it's a movie or not, but it's getting optioned to become a franchise, is what they're calling it, which is an interesting wording. So I'm imagining maybe a show, probably a show for something that's political like this. It's, if you don't know, Undiscovered Country is about America putting up these walls and not interacting with anyone outside of America for, I think, 30 years, and then opening the doors, and that's where the start of the book starts.
And is this book out yet, or
no? It doesn't come out till November.
Oh wow! So,
I wrote a bit of news about this on Friday, and what was interesting to me, and what I pointed out in this, is that it's got to be a really good comic book if someone's already optioning it before it's even come out yet. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure the producers who are producing this probably have already read it, so they have the inside track, I'm sure.
Who knows? Or the name sells Scott Snyder and people are snatching it up, you know?
That's true. Are you interested at all in the series, or does this make you more interested in the series?
No. The movie aspect doesn't, because I feel like, and this is something that a lot of people talked about, is a lot of people kind of write comics now to get movie deals or TV show deals.
Right.
They're kind of like, you know, spec scripts or whatever, or pitches. I don't think Scott and Charles are doing that.
No.
You know, they're both talented writers. I think you describing it just now, I don't know much about it, but you describing it sounds really interesting, and I'm sure it's great. Who's the artist on it?
Giuseppe Camicoli.
Oh yeah, he's great. Yeah.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it out.
The production company is New Republic Pictures, which I'm not super familiar with.
Yeah, me neither.
I know Scott Snyder's come out on record saying he never wants to write movies, because he gets that question a lot. Mm-hmm. He always wants to write comics, but now him and Soule are writing or adapting this into a screenplay, which probably isn't that hard when you think about it. They've already got it written out and thought about. I think they've been working together on this for 3 or 4 years, I think, what they were saying to people.
Yeah, I know. I mean, not to change subject, but I know Donny Cates is also, was it God Country, his book?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He's writing the screenplay too. I think it's good when, you know, the people that created the book also get to write the screenplay.
Yes.
Whether it's any good, you know, we'll see. Because I think it's writing for two different mediums. So sometimes they need someone else to come in and help out. But I think it's cool that they get to do that.
Yeah, for sure. In our next bit of news, we talk about this every month on the show. The sales for August came out, and they are flat. Which basically means they haven't really gone up or down. But considering that there's one less week in August this year than it was last year, that's actually saying something. It's pretty good. A couple highlights I just wanted to throw out there. Once again, Marvel is killing it on dollar share and unit share. Unit share meaning how many books they sold, and dollar obviously meaning how much money they made. They took home 46% dollars and 49% unit.
Wow.
Almost 49.96%, by the way. Almost 50% of all comic books sold in August were Marvel comics. Isn't that insane?
What was the top book?
The top book was Absolute Carnage number one.
So they are literally killing it.
Oh, look at you.
That's why you bring me
so
on.
Clever, so clever. The second best book was Marvel Comics number 1000. So they took the top two.
That worked out well for them.
It really did. Everyone was very angry that they just slapped a 1000 on it. But look, it worked, guys. So stop being angry. Another big reason for all of the sales was House of X and Powers of X.
Yeah,
which
look at that solid block there.
They took 4, 5, 6, and 7 on the list.
I mean, speaking as a longtime X-Men fan, that's, you know, I remember in the Wizard magazine back in the day, Uncanny was always number one. Mm-hmm. So nice to see the X-Men back on top again. Almost on top.
We'll see if it's sustained. Maybe, you know, maybe Dawn of X, it'll even continue to grow. Who knows? No surprise, also, Batman takes 3 slots because he has the Batman Superman number one by Joshua Williamson, who's actually been on this show as well, and just keep name dropping, and then Batman by Tom King, and then Batman Curse of the White Knight by Sean Murphy. So no surprises there. Batman's usually in the top, but interesting enough, Immortal Hulk, which we talked about last month, not in the list, so it's fallen off. But again, Hulk isn't one of those primo titles that just sells because of the name.
Yeah, I just want to add that I talked to Tom King a few weeks ago at Terrificon.
Okay, good. Great. Hey, I just want to add that we're both going to be talking to Daniel Kibblesmith in a couple
minutes.
Wait,
really?
Yeah. That's coming up.
People have already tuned out.
Basically. One other thing I want to just point out is The Boys Omnibus sold really well. It was 9th in graphic novels for August.
Interesting.
Most likely because of the show.
Yeah, and that shows, you know, I know a lot of times people talk about how movies don't translate to comic sales, but
good point.
Seem to be the case here, maybe just with trade paperback sales.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, people are trying to catch up. I actually, that's funny. This last weekend, I went home and I dug into my box of comics and found The Boys, Volume 1. I'm going to look at it, see if it's true to the show.
And it's nice to see there's a Stan Lee, Steve Ditko omnibus on this list, too. So, you know, a lot of times classic creators don't get their due. Obviously, Stan Lee and Steve Ditko are pretty big, but it's good to see people still appreciate the old days.
Yeah, and I don't think it'll ever die. Those guys are legends. In our last bit of news, and yes, it's solicit news, DC Comics came out with their solicits on Friday, late Friday. So this is like sharp as attack news. You don't even know what's happening. It's so fast. It's so quick. And there's just
like attack.
They're very quick when if you throw them. The three things I want to point out. One, Frank Miller is returning to The Dark Knight Returns for a one-shot called The Golden Child. Say, what? He's going back to the well? He just did this 2 years ago. I don't know if you remember, but what was it? The Dark Knight 3, The Master Race, that came out. And it was all right. I reviewed most of those issues, and Adam Kubert did the art. It was good. It was decent. And this one, it's drawn by, I forgot the name, Raphael Grampa, with color by Jordi Belair, who she seems to be on the Primo books every month. And, okay, other news. Doomsday Clock number 12, coming out December 18th. We talked about this recently on the show. No idea. But Gary Frank, you know, he said, I think we talked about this last week, he said that it's coming out in November. Everyone was like, but Gary, the solicits for November already came out, so there's no way that's possible. Well, only a couple weeks later. So I want to, for the record, point out that it took Doomsday Clock 2 years to come out with 12 issues. Mm-hmm. That's a long time.
What did you do in 2 years?
I got like 3 raises. I'm so awesome.
I met Tom King a couple weeks ago.
So that will be pretty cool to see how that wraps up, in part because the book has very much felt like it needs to be read in one sitting. So maybe people will change their minds about it and feel a little bit more positive.
I have not read any of the issues. I've been waiting for the trade. So
in March, say, you could probably get it.
Yeah, 2020, I'll read it.
And the last thing that struck me as interesting to point out in the DC solicits, Lois Lane number 7 comes out January 1st. So
that's Happy New Year.
Yeah, and we find out in the solicit that Superman, when the Man of Steel decides to reveal his identity to the world.
Oh my God.
So first of all, the way that's worded, he probably doesn't yet tell the world who he is, because it says he's decided to reveal. It doesn't say he does reveal.
So he tells Lois, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. Mm-hmm. When he does it, who knows?
Who knows? But it's coming, and boy, oh boy, as we know, that's a big thing to, what is it? The Pandora's box? Yeah.
Sinister secret.
it took Spider-Man like a ton of convoluted storytelling to get his identity back in the bottle. So we'll see how realistic this is. Maybe everyone loses their memory or something.
Well, let me throw something out there. Do you think that something happens in Doomsday Clock 12 to make him do this?
Oh, that's right. Because it's the big showdown between Dr. Manhattan and Superman. Mm-hmm. Maybe he realizes his identity is baloney when there's a blue naked man that can change reality. It would make me change reality. All right, so that's the last bit of news. Some interesting tidbits in there. We're going to move on to our next segment called Top Books of Last Week, where we pick our top 2 favorite books that came out last week. Because we have Daniel on later, we're going to be reducing our second picks to one sentence. To start this segment, every week we talk about comicbookroundup.com, basically the Rotten Tomatoes of comic book reviewing, and we just point out the top critic pick and fan pick. This week, the top fan pick with 3 reviews was Punisher Kill Crew number 2 with a 9.3. I actually reviewed that book at aftcomics.com, and I really liked it. It was pretty amazing. The art is very, very good.
Very cool.
By Juan Ferreira. And the top critic pick is Loki number 3 with a 9.3. Yeah, that's right. Loki number 3 by Daniel Kibblesmith.
Wow.
It had 5 reviews, and I was one of them, and I obviously gave it a high score. It's a solid book, and I will actually talk about it in a moment. But what I care about most in the world right now is what Chris Hassan thinks is the second best, the number one loser book of the week.
And this is only one sentence?
That's right.
Oh, geez.
What was your pick?
Well, mine was Powers of X, number 4, written by Jonathan Hickman with art by R.B. Silva. One sentence, man.
No pressure.
Sinister Secrets got me excited.
If you made it rhyme, it would have been good.
I don't know.
Sinister Secrets got me... What rhymes with secrets?
Nothing. Insects? No. Well, now I just sound like an idiot.
Okay, your second favorite book. My second favorite book was Loki number 3 by Daniel Kibblesmith with art by Oscar Bazalgette.
Yeah,
Bazalgette. Very good book.
We could ask Daniel.
My sentence is, Loki has always been the clever type, and this story meets the lofty cleverness of the god of tricks.
Okay, I feel like you pulled that from your review.
I literally pulled that from my review.
It's better than mine.
Okay, now, Chris, drum roll. What is your favorite book that came out last week?
Are you adding the drum roll in post?
No, it's in my mind. Okay. I want everyone to imagine drum rolling.
Okay, everybody got it? All right.
Okay, good.
It was Amazing Spider-Man 29 by Nick Spencer and Francesco Manna. Uh-huh. And this was kind of just like an in-between issue of Amazing Spider-Man. I've been a fan of this book since the first issue. I just like that it's really returned the Peter Parker-esque aspect of Spider-Man's life to the title. I enjoy having MJ there. I enjoy the relationship drama. And it's just this one's such a classic Peter Parker down in his luck story. I don't want to give it away, but he's upset that MJ's going out to Hollywood to make her movie with Mysterio, which is that's the plot of Leah Williams' upcoming miniseries, right?
Yes, yep.
Yeah, and Spider-Man's, he's happy for her MJ, but also he feels like, she's going to slip away again, and then there's some other stuff that happens, which I can't remember, but it's been a long week, I've been sick. But
no,
yeah,
I hear you.
I think it's a great book. I think Nick Spencer's doing a great job, and...
you just like the cliffhanger. That's what you like.
I did like the cliffhanger, yeah. I like that soap opera aspect, what I love about Spider-Man and the X-Men.
Yeah, it definitely had you hit the nail on the head there. It definitely had a soap opera feel. Because, Aunt May's there talking to Peter and connecting with him.
And it's a dense book. Every issue a lot happens. Some of these books, you're done in like 5 minutes. But
yeah.
Spider-Man, every month, it's always a lot of dialogue, a lot of subplots. And it's just, it really reminds me of the classic Stan Lee stories.
Mm, yeah. Nice. I liked it. I didn't like it as much as you did.
It's not a competition.
Well, I only say that because my number one pick was King Thor number 1, written by Jason Aaron with art by Asad Ribic. This was an interesting book for me to review. I got to review it early in an advanced review format, and I was doing a little digging, and I realized that I had read the first issue of Aaron and Ribic's run back in 2012 when it came out. So I've been not only have I been writing reviews for a long time, but it brought me back to the early days when I pretty much was at AIPT for only about a year at that point. And, nothing. Sometimes things don't change that much, even though they've been telling this story on and off for so many years. This issue really brings you back to the beginning. I don't want to spoil it just like you didn't want to spoil yours, but there are elements in it that are straight from what they were doing in that first run. And there's some epic fighting between Loki and Thor. They basically stab each other so many times they should be dead. And there's another plot with Thor's daughters who are... There's something that they find that could potentially change everything. This is a series that's set in the far, far future. Thor has basically repopulated the Earth with new humans, or what's left of humans. He hasn't populated them, like, personally, okay? what I mean is, like, he's trying to foster another Earth at the end of times, and he knows everything is going to go away. It's going to be the end of the universe, but he continues on. And all the heroes are dead. There's a couple villains still alive, though. So basically Aaron can do whatever he wants with the story, which is really cool. And it's just beautiful, beautiful book by Ribic. He just gets better and better every year that goes by. Check it out.
I will check it out.
No, you won't. You don't like Thor.
I love Thor.
You only like X-Men. If Thor was a mutant, you'd read it.
Is he? Is he a mutant?
I don't know. Maybe that's the twist at the end. In our next segment, top books for next week, we're going to talk about the number one book we're looking forward to. Now, when there's 100 to 180 comics out every week, it's difficult sometimes to narrow this down, and that's where we come in. Not for Chris, though, because he only likes one thing, and I just mentioned it.
X-Men.
What is your most anticipated book next week? And I probably could guess.
Yeah, it's from Xenoscope. It's House of X number 5.
Xenoscope, wow. Yeah.
No, it's House of X number 5 by Jonathan Hickman, and this one's by Pepe Larrez. I mean, do I have to explain it?
Well, it's interesting. We're only two away from the finish of this, right?
Yeah, what I've loved about the series is that every single issue is unique. You know, like, we don't know what's... I mean, I think last week with the Sinister Secrets issue, we had no idea it was going to be a comedy issue, going from an issue where, spoilers, all the X-Men were slaughtered. And then we go then to, comedy with Sinister. So, and almost like slapsticky too, like when he's like offing different Sinisters. So we really have no idea what to expect next week. And that's exciting.
Now, House of X, traditionally it's focused on Magneto and Xavier. Or no, is it, sorry, correct me here. Powers of X is set in three different timelines.
History, and then House of X is kind of like the modern timeline, we think.
Yes, gotcha. And it's a lot about Moira and her place in the story.
Well, maybe. We're not sure. I mean, we only saw Moira like once for a full issue of House of X.
It's fascinating to me. We're so close to the end already. And yet I feel like we have so much farther to go.
I'm wondering when we get to the pod people.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
First saw in, like, the first like three pages of the comic of House of X 1 was... Xavier awakening X-Men from pods.
So, and looking so creepy doing it.
Yeah, so I think we know how we get there, but again, everything I've thought I've known since the beginning, Jonathan Hickman has given me a curveball, so
yeah.
I can't wait to see what happens.
One thing that he hasn't done is bring in that yellow dude with the horns.
From Avengers?
Yeah.
X-Nihilo or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right? He hasn't done anything with that guy, right?
No.
That's right. So that's completely a wrong way to think about it because of his like weird stuff on Mars. That's why people were thinking he might be involved.
We have no idea what happens next.
Are you uncomfortable with my line of questioning?
I feel like Jordan's going to come over and silence me.
Oh, somehow you know. Oh my God, guys. Chris Hassan knows all of the things that are going to happen. So just start messaging him or DMing him on Twitter right now.
No, I know nothing.
So my most anticipated book out next week is a book called Spider-Man Number 1, written by J.J. Abrams, Henry Abrams, and art by Sarah Pacelli.
This is not the Todd McFarlane book from the 90s.
No, it is not. No.
This is the Henry Abrams one.
This is the Henry Abrams 2. Henry Abrams is the son of J.J. Abrams. There was a bit of an uproar a couple weeks or months ago now.
Months, yeah.
Where folks thought, oh, this is nepotism. J.J. Abrams, Nick Lowe came. He's told the story 100 times now. He told it at San Diego Comic-Con when I was there. Basically, he's been trying to court J.J. Abrams to write something at Marvel. And it came up where J.J. was like, hey, how about I write something with my son? And he said, yes, please.
How old is Henry Abrams?
Jeez, I think he's in his 20s.
Okay.
Yeah. He's in college, or he's college age anyway. There's a couple promo videos of them talking about this. What's really interesting to me is the fact that Pacelli is involved. Sarah's just an amazing artist. Mm-hmm. It's going to look so clean and so good. I am curious, if you think about it this way, everyone's like, oh, Henry's writing. It's really Henry writing it. Well, J.J. Abrams produces a lot of movies. He doesn't direct a lot of movies necessarily. He's producing a lot, though. And when it comes to a producer like him or Spielberg, they'll come in and they'll offer ideas and jazz something up so that it goes from a 7 to an 11. And I have a feeling that this collaboration is probably like that. And so I'm curious to see how it comes out. I mean, obviously, J.J. Abrams has done a lot of excellent work. One of my favorite Mission Impossible movies was directed by and written by him. He did the pilot for Lost, stuff like that. So there's probably going to be a lot of mystery. We all know J.J. Abrams is all about that mystery box plotting. And there's going to be a new villain. And we know that there are high stakes because this will be in continuity.
Yeah, it's been a while since a comic's come out with this much buzz around it in a way that... I mean, obviously, Jonathan Hickman, we know his track record, so we kind of know what to expect. But J.J. and Henry, we've never seen him before. And it reminds me a lot of when Kevin Smith came to comics. And
right,
there was all that hype. And obviously, he delivered at first. I think his later stuff kind of, you know, dropped off. But his Daredevil was very good. So we'll see. We'll see what happens here.
Or even Joss Whedon. Remember when he entered the scene?
True.
Yeah.
And then there's others. There was that Back to the Future guy, Bob Gale, who did a Spider-Man arc. And
that's
that
right.
was not very good. Some people don't translate that well to the comics.
Some of his Back to the Future books were all right. Not all of them, but some.
His Spider-Man was not good.
Good to know. Look that up, folks. Go read it for yourself. Figure it out.
But we've come full circle from talking about Scott Snyder writing movies to movie people writing comics.
This is true. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover, Junior, we pick our favorite cover art for a comic that comes out next week, September 18th. I'm going to go first. My favorite cover art is Flash Forward number 1 by Evan Shaner. Evan Doc Shaner, as he goes by sometimes. Really cool cover. You've got the very traditional superhero standing in front of this like cosmic space background with this strange, scary face in the stars. And it instantly makes me interested in the book. I'm very curious to see what they do, but obviously this art is just dazzling and very colorful. If you've got a lot of color, I'll probably like your cover. And I recommend this book simply on the cover art alone.
Oh, so you do judge a book by its cover.
Isn't that the cover artist's job?
Can I do my pick?
Okay, go.
It is House of X number 5 by Pepe Larraz. I tried to find something non-X-Men, but this just spoke to me. And this is actually, fans out there of X-Men Monday, Dave actually makes the feature image for every week. And this one was used for the X-Villains edition about 2 weeks ago.
It looked good. He filled the space very well.
Yes. So this cover is this apocalypse, you know, hulking. Pepe draws an amazing hulking apocalypse. And he's just slowly moving through, what is it, like a swamp or like a waterlands, whatever it's called. You can tell I don't go outside a lot.
Yeah, and that's swamp, yeah.
Yeah, he's just moving through, obviously approaching Krakoa. Just what's he going to do when he gets there, you know, is we haven't seen Apocalypse in a while. So, we have in the Powers of X, but we'll see what happens. But yeah, it's cool.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, that's it for that segment. Next segment, an interview with Daniel Kibblesmith. He is the writer of Loki, the current series coming out at Marvel. Actually, a new issue came out just this week. He's also written Black Panther vs. Deadpool, Lockjaw. Have you heard any of these before? Harley Quinn. The guy's been everywhere. Quantum and Woody, Valiant High, Rugrats. Come on, guys. Do I hear clapping? Is that clapping I hear? He's known for his comedy writing. Obviously, he is a writer at Late Night with Stephen Colbert. But we're going to be talking to him about breaking in and the comic book industry and his writing and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. Thank you for being on the show, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is really exciting. You've had a big week with Loki number 3.
Yes.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yes. Loki number 3 came out on Wednesday, this past Wednesday. We're recording this on a Friday. I'm very tired. but I think I wear it well.
You do, yeah. Do you do a lot of promotion for the book, by the way?
I'm not sure. I'm on Twitter regardless. I don't have the opportunity to go to a lot of stores or conventions, but I'm on the internet all day, so I talk about it pretty much nonstop there. You know, I tell friends. try to keep you know, like my like elementary school teachers in the loop. That's actually not entirely a joke. I did send I sent a bunch of copies of Loki number 1 to my old high school's science fiction and fantasy club.
Oh, that's cool.
Which was a refuge when I was a teenager, and I thought that they might get a kick out of it. And I'm told that they did, which, you know, is very flattering. And also what I hope they would tell me, even if they didn't, even if they were like, you know, Neopets now.
Speaking of high school, I mean, our first question is kind of going all the way back to the beginning. Just when did you first fall in love with comics, and, you know, have they been a constant presence in your life ever since?
Sure. I mean, I think of it as though I came to comics late, but I don't. That's not true at all. It's because when you're a kid, you know, you've only been around for a few years, and everything gets sort of magnified. My dad always loved comics, so he would try to get me into them, and I didn't really take to them until I was like 9 or 10, which to me still feels late because it's something that so many people sort of have going for them from the womb. But I came to them sort of sideways because I was trying to sort of, I think as a young child, have my own identity and my own hobbies and stuff. But I loved video games, and so many of the video games at the time were based on IP. So I liked Superman and the idea of Batman and Spider-Man and Wonder Woman, you know, and we had like a drink cup with Dark Side on it. And I was like, okay, that's what a bad guy. His name is Dark Side. That's what the bad guy looks like. But I never read comic books. They'd be, you know, the Ruby Spears Superman cartoon, or, you know, they'd be more like a cartoonish sort of, you know, like Gumby or something, you know, it's just a character. And then we went to the video arcade, and I've told this story a bazillion times, so forgive me if the people listening have heard this before. But the six player X-Men arcade game.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah,
Classic.
blew my mind. The veil was lifted from my eyes. I was like, I need to know everything about this. This is what I like now. And then, you know, that was based on the first animated X-Men pilot, the Pride of the X-Men, which I didn't see until way, way later. But the actual X-Men animated series dropped shortly thereafter. And what is frustrating about getting into comics, I think, for a lot of adults is how much minutia there is to mine through. But when you're a kid, you know, when you're the age that you would be getting into, like, you know, something like Pokemon or something, that's the entire point, is that it's a bottomless pit and everything just raises more questions. So the fact that the X-Men animated series came out and it was none of the characters from the video, you know, it was a Storm, a version of Storm, a version of Cyclops, a version of Wolverine, and everything was different because what, 10, 15 years of comic books had happened in the meantime. X-Men and then Spider-Man comics came into my life, and I was like, okay, we're gonna figure this out. I'm gonna find the dotted line between Nightcrawler and Dazzler with her short hair and brown Wolverine, and how it gets to these cartoons that are sort of simultaneously inspired by the comics of today, but also like a lot of Claremont Byrne stuff. And my dad had reprints of a lot of the Claremont Byrne stuff in the form of the classic X-Men
Oh,
run,
yeah.
the new covers. So from there, I was able to kind of get into my dad's sort of silver and bronze age collection and just got this big sort of hierarchy-free info dump where it wasn't clear to me which characters were A-list or B-list or C-list or D-list. I just got them all at the same time and, you know, had my favorites just based on who I liked, which I think still speaks to why I gravitate towards a lot of the B and C list characters.
There's kind of something to like controlling a character in a video game and then getting more interested in the character. There's like a connection there.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that the sort of like intimacy of that, you know, the little
Right.
avatar, it's like I'm emotionally invested in you. When you get hurt, I get hurt. And it's an arcade, so it costs me money. So I need to know everything about you so we can stay alive and keep our quarters.
Which of the X-Men did you play as?
Nightcrawler,
Nightcrawler,
who remains my favorite character in comic books. Yeah, although because it was of that video game, and the way it was constructed, I believed that Nightcrawler's superpower was to turn into like a ball of opalescent flame and just sort of
okay.
like zigzag back and forth, kind of like tearing through everybody.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I read the comic books that I realized that was a exaggeration of his teleportation ability, that it was really more of a functional thing.
Well, you know, House of X is not over yet. You know, Hickman could be bringing
That's true.
Oh yeah, sure. That's life six, right? I'm sorry, that's probably.
We had X-Men editor Jordan White on here once and a couple of months ago now, and he was talking a lot about the Banff cloud It's supposed to smell, right?
Yeah, it smells like brimstone, and
Brimstone, yeah.
right.
and so they compare it to rotten eggs sometimes in the comic.
So he's constantly bamfing around, and nobody's actually commenting on the smell very often.
Not as often as you'd think. Sometimes they'll comment on it at the beginning of an X-Men story when they're still sort of clearing their throats and doing little, they're playing baseball or basketball, and or they've just arrived from a. They're back at the mansion after a trip to space. Like he'll teleport in, and maybe like Myra will say something to the effect of "Please don't do that," to kind of just have a little comic relief and clear the air.
Sure.
Pun not intended,
Oh.
retroactively intended.
Did you read comics as you grew older, or did you kind of drift away and then drift back?
I drifted away and drifted back the way that a lot of people my age did, because my obsession corresponded with the 90s boom. And it's very easy to get overwhelmed and a little disillusioned. So I was a subscriber because of I loved Nightcrawler. I was a subscriber to Excalibur, and because I was a child in the 90s, I was a subscriber to Spider-Man as well, and those were the two I got every month. So I got hit with Age of Apocalypse and the Clone Saga at the same time.
Oh yeah.
I really just I was just like a year too young to even try to keep up. All I knew was that everything I liked was now thrown into question. And not in a way that appealed to me at the time.
Right.
So they were really expensive. And then the other thing that was happening at the same time was collectible card games were becoming a big thing in my social circle. So if you have the income of a child and your friends are playing Magic the Gathering, or we would play the Marvel CCG, we played Overpower at the time.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
So I started spending more money on that stuff, and then kind of fell off both. And it wasn't until late high school, early college, that friends who had weathered that storm started giving me like Vertigo books and the like Busiek, Perez Avengers, and Astro City, and all of these things that were like of very, very high quality and started to appeal to me as a teenager and a college student. And I was able to start reading the more sort of sophisticated comics and falling in love with the medium again. And from there, I never stopped.
So, at what point did you kind of develop an interest in writing comics? Because obviously, getting into a TV writing, it's a very different path than getting into comics.
Yeah, I've always pursued both simultaneously because you never really know what's going to click. Like you don't know who's going to say yes to something early in your career. So I probably began, when I was a kid, like kids do, I would draw my own superheroes and make the Xerox comics with the little staple on the upper left-hand corner, as though that's how comic books are. It's like a doc, like a mortgage. And so I always was aware that I, as a writer, could make them. I went to film school, and it was very difficult to do things that were big, weird genre things on a film student budget. So we'd make films, student films that had like masked characters in them, and had like kind of superhero-y or very Neil Gaiman influenced kind of. Student films, very, very, very arty, but to what end? And it wasn't until kind of late college, I was a projectionist, and a friend at the theater gave me his stack of trades to read while I was there. And the idea when you're a film student who becomes a projectionist is that you'll watch all of the movies. And I tried, but it was actually kind of difficult because of the way the projector was set up. You were looking at everything through this chest-high window with no sound. It wasn't romantic at all. It wasn't like Cinema Paradiso. It was a chore. So I would just read all of Alan Moore Swamp Thing. I would read all of Planetary. And that was really when I sort of started as a visual as a visual thinker and storyteller, seeing it as something that I liked as much or more than anything else I was trying to do, and also something that was a lot more immediate. You know, you could make a comic book with a friend. You didn't need any budget other than, you know, treating the artist fairly.
Right.
But you didn't need to rent equipment or find locations or anything like that. So when I went to Columbia College of Chicago, and they have a program where students can spend their final semester in Los Angeles. And I interned for management companies and talent agencies, like places like that. But I ended up moving back to Chicago and interning with an entertainment lawyer who represented predominantly comic book writers, and started really seriously looking at how these things are put together and how they're pitched and to who, and going to conventions, the Chicago conventions, every time, and trying to talk to as many creators as possible. So eventually, while I was doing comedy in Chicago with my comedian friends, and doing a lot of like YouTube shorts and sketch and a little bit of stand-up and improv, I was also writing scripts and just finding like artists on Craigslist and Tumblr and people who, you know, I could put together minis with. And eventually, just from talking about it on social media a lot, I ended up becoming friends with a Valiant editor at the time named Alejandro Arbona. And he asked me if I wanted to do some humor strips, basically, like some single page gags for some of the Valiant anniversary issues. So that was my kind of break in, was just kind of being around and talking about comics all of the time, and having other finished work that people could, you know, see like, oh, this guy is serious. He, you know, is trying very hard to do this.
Right.
And like, if we give him an assignment, it might get turned in on time. So that was when I was able to start getting paid gigs there. It's the same thing as most jobs. You know, one small yes leads to a medium-sized yes, and then you keep doing it. You keep getting things in on time, and being a not a maniac to work with. It's a fairly straight path for a while. I just want to keep doing it for as much as I can.
Well, Loki number three was really good. I reviewed it this week at aptcomics.com, and good job on that, first of all.
Thank you. Thanks.
I have to say, Loki, this series has so many imaginative ideas, but at the same time, the pacing is just so perfect. And that's something I've been reviewing comics. I've got like 2,500 comic book reviews, and I have to say, over the years, I've realized pacing is like everything. And I was just curious, can you talk a little bit about that? Like, do you think about pacing when you're writing scripts?
I definitely do, but I think about it while I am writing it. I think it's very much like I used to edit a lot of video, obviously, as somebody who was making sketch comedy and little films and stuff on my own. And my first long form comic was Valiant High. And I'm really proud of it, and it has a huge cast. And whenever a scene in Valiant High was over, I would just cut to the next characters and see what they were doing. And it was very easy to kind of get into that rhythm and let things sort of naturally take their course. And then the next thing I did was Lockjaw. And it's all about this dog, and I saddled D-Man with him. And that's it. You have a nonverbal protagonist who's driving everything, and a relatively small cast. You know, it's like a road movie, so you're really stuck with these people. So it's a lot. You lose immediately all of the tools of being able to just like rip cord out of a scene when it's done. It's like everything suddenly has to be really motivated and driven. You can't just like have some funny banter and then cut away. So I suddenly became very aware of like, okay, I have been operating totally on instinct, and now I have to learn a new kind of storytelling for a smaller cast. So I guess I just sort of I just sort of play it, you know, when it feels like it's over, and then you cut away and do something else. But I had a pretty strong outline on Loki, on this first arc of Loki. So I think I had a good idea of what I needed to fit in and when things had to happen. And then once I had that, then the sort of joyful panic sets in, where it's like, this is also a Marvel comic. You're getting to write a Marvel comic, and I want people to get their money's worth. I want to get as much in here, and that was also true of Lockjaw. I want to get as much in here as possible, just in case this is the last Marvel comic that I ever write. So I just sort of set the tent poles in Loki, and then tried to make everything in between as jam-packed and interesting as possible. But I largely do think about it, but it's very hard to articulate even to myself how I am thinking about it. But basically, anytime I feel that something is over, I just try to stay aware of how many pages I have left in the book and how much space moments really need. I think that's also very important. I've learned in my still very nascent career as a comic book writer that I can have 25 pages of story to tell in 20 pages, but if something needs to be a splash page, it really needs to be a splash page.
Right.
You learn to sort of prioritize the breathing room on the stuff that really needs it. And if it's a matter of cutting or cramming later, take stuff where it's going to do you the most good, have the most impact on the audience, or hit the character hardest.
Well, you mentioned page counts and pacing. I'm wondering, do you find that writing comedy in a comics format is different than, you mentioned YouTube videos or on Stephen Colbert?
Yeah, I do. I think that it's more like I do a lot of Twitter and put stuff on Medium, or I'll submit stuff to McSweeney's or The New Yorker. And I think that it comes down to the difference in my mind comes down to the expectation that somebody might laugh out loud, especially a audience, like a group of people might laugh out loud. Because in comic books, especially somebody with Loki, who's sort of sassy, he can do like a lot of little tags. We call them tags at work a lot. Like, he can gild the lily as much as he wants, and that's something I really enjoy as a writer. It's kind of a guilty pleasure. So if you're writing for a audience full of people, it's a lot more punchline, setup, punchline, laughter. Because if you give them the expectation that the joke is over and they are allowed to laugh, and you break that tension, they're going to laugh, especially in a group. And if you're doing your job right, God willing, they're going to laugh. And then if you have some like little flourish or something that comes after that, they're just going to miss that. Because the way that you've constructed that, that sentence, that moment, tells them when it's over. And cues them to sort of let themselves go and participate in it, and and break the tension, and that's where the laughter comes from. Not to get all Bill Nye about it, but in a comic book, it's this much kind of quieter, calmer, more intimate experience. At least where comedic writing is concerned, it's kind of character driven and personality driven. And Loki can add as many little flourishes as he wants. And I really enjoy writing stuff where he just kind of trails off. A lot of Loki's, if you've been reading Loki, I don't want to let people too far behind the curtain, but you'll notice a lot of what he says, the last thing he says is sort of just to himself. He's literally narrating this comic. I wanted it to be a first person perspective, like most Marvel comics are, because the idea is that Loki is a superhero in this one. So he talks to the reader the same way that Spider-Man talks to the reader. But when he's talking to other characters, he also just kind of trails off and mumbles something to himself, something kind of crappy.
Right, and like the captions too, they're really well done. I love the what are the Loki tips? What is it? Sorry.
Kister's tips. Yeah, it's
Yes.
very it's somewhat, I think, somewhat inspired by like the like Nintendo Power,
Oh
you
yeah.
know, like old like a tips and tricks.
Back to video games. When are you going to write a video game?
Yeah, wow. That's what right? Are you yeah, who's offering? I'll do.
I think Sony has Spider-Man, so.
That's my understanding. Yeah, as of late, I love video games, but I do sort of love retro video games. I missed a couple generations, so the stuff I like, I came back hard with the Switch
Oh,
because
yeah.
it's so accessible.
The
But
Breath of the Wild system is what I call it.
that's right. I like Breath of the Wild. Not to get totally off subject, I like Breath of the Wild, but I am a little bit bored by open world stuff in general, and Breath of the Wild in particular, because I'll be following like a shrine beep, and I'll just be walking through a field for an hour, and then it rains, and then I have to climb a sheer cliff face in the rain, and I'm sure this is fun for someone because I have so many friends who have beaten the crap out of this game and gotten all of like the glowing motorcycles and crap, but. I can't really get any traction in Breath of the Wild because of the also the amount of time that it takes.
Right, yeah, it's so
Because
hard.
that is time that I have a full-time television writing job, and I should probably be finishing a Loki comic instead of playing a fantasy. I have a different guy in green with a sword.
I was the same way with Red Dead Redemption 2. I was so excited, and then I was like, wait, I know, I will never turn this on, and I don't.
We tried so hard. We have the PlayStation as well, and my wife got really excited about it because she read an article about like some crazy death of a horse or something, just like the depths to which things could go wrong in this game.
Yes,
So she thought that it was going to be this kind of this wall-to-wall chaos. And then like I think we got about like 45 minutes into this thing. It was a lot of hunting and snow, and we just tapped out
I
because
was the same.
that's not what I got out of video games. No, that's not what made me fall in love with them. I missed all of the, you know, I never played GTA, I never played God of War. I missed all the big things where you kind of walk around, you know, or The Last of Us, like anything that has like rich storytelling in it. I unfortunately just I have no relationship with it. I want to play Super Mario World because it's back. I want to play Duck Game because it's a perfect creation. The things that are sort of fast and casual is what I have time and interest for. A lot of like 15-minute bursts.
Speaking of big ideas, Loki is just filled with them, and I'm like really surprised because it feels almost sometimes like an event style book in that there's always something new and big to think about. And I'm not going to spoil anything, but like even in issue three, there's a couple things. It made me wonder though, if you had the opportunity to do a Marvel event, to be the curator of a Marvel event, do you have any ideas or do you have a lead character in mind that you'd love to tackle in a Marvel event?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I've been asked lots of times because I haven't written that many Marvel comics, who else I'd like to write. But framing it in an event is really interesting because you start to think about like their connections and their possibilities. I mean, Loki would be great, but he is so frequently at the center of events. He was, you know, obviously War of the Realms and the Infinity Wars situation. Where he was on the crazy team with Wolverine and Emma Frost, which I really enjoyed, the Jerry Duggan kind of mini event. That's a great question. I the most obvious answer, so I'm not gonna fight it, would be Deadpool. I got to write Deadpool on Black Panther versus Deadpool right before Loki started. And I know that Deadpool is involved in events. I know that he was in like Axis and Avengers versus X-Men, and he always has this kind of wild card role. It's interesting that a character with that much exposure has never had like a Spider-Verse attached to him. Or if he, you know, if he has, it's not something that may be involved like the larger Marvel universe. And he knows everybody. Captain America says he's an Avenger. So a Deadpool-centric event. You know, now that I've said this out loud, I'm sure Kelly Thompson will do it and do a great job. But I'll tweet at her and say, like, hey, you should have this happen.
Yeah, that's right. She's taking over Deadpool.
I can't wait. I cannot wait.
I feel like there's still room for a Nightcrawler series from you. I think that'd be
Ooh,
pretty good.
yeah.
I love that. I brought it up when we were talking about what might happen after Lockjaw. And I think that the Age of X-Men mini had just been like staffed up. I think that
Amazing Nightcrawler.
Yes. So a Nightcrawler solo thing was already happening at the last time that I asked. But yeah, Nightcrawler's weird. He's such a great team character. And I've read all of the solo Nightcrawler stuff, and most of it's pretty different. I remember there's the really broody one with the Derek Robertson art, that kind of treats him. It's almost like a John Constantine kind of take on Nightcrawler, which I rather like because he's this religious, demonic, foreign figure. And then the other ones are very swashbuckly and very fun, which is also Nightcrawler. But yeah, any opportunity. What I'd love to do like a Nightcrawler team up book, the way that they used to do with Spider-Man or The Thing, and just see people bouncing off of him, because I think that's like so many of the X-Men, that is the appeal to me, is that he is talking to Wolverine, or he is making light of something with Cyclops.
It's funny, when you and Dave are talking about video games, I do the X-Men Monday column at AAPT with Jordan White every Monday. And I remember a previous one, I think a fan asked Jordan a question like, what X-Men story from other media would you want to bring into canon? And he actually mentioned the arcade game. And I thought, oh my God, like, get Daniel and Jordan together and you can write that series.
Oh, he knows. He knows. He's got
This is
my number. Yeah. No, that'd be great. The plot of the game, if I recall, is that it is a near future sort of pre-apocalyptic thing where like 7 foot tall sentinels are sort of taking over.
Oh
'Cause
no,
they
not
have to be
7 foot.
small enough. Yeah, but
Oh,
there's a lot of them. There's so
okay.
many. And
Yeah,
then later there's people with alligator heads.
yeah.
I have, this is, for me, it's like nearly 30 years later, and I've still not pieced together what in the X-Men arcade game is in the comics and where. And right after this, if I don't totally fall asleep, I might find an annotation or something. See if I can see, like, all right, those giant bees, what are those from? Like, is that like a Kazar thing? Like, where'd those guys factor in?
This is where Hickman's taking us. He's taking us right into that, and then you take over after
Sure.
him.
I'm sure it'll be an effortless act to follow.
Well, speaking of like future plans, I mean, obviously, I follow you on Twitter, and I know you keep up with politics, obviously, and a lot of your tweets are pretty serious. You talk about serious things. So I'm wondering, do you think you have like more serious comic ideas for the future? Kind of, I know a lot of your work is humorous.
Yeah, I'd like that. I think that when I went to film school, I always loved comedy, but I just sort of thought I wanted to make movies. And when I went to school, I tried making dramatic short stuff, but I was 19, and it was very cloying and not for anybody. And I became friends with comedians, and this was also around the time that YouTube was just getting started, and you could get people to watch music videos or comedy shorts, but that was about it in terms of original content. Nobody wanted to watch like a 4 minute dramatic short film. So I didn't put a ton of effort into making anything like that for a really long time. But what I like about comics is that everything I've done in comics, and I think all good comedy has the stakes of drama, and all good drama has comedy in it, so you can breathe. And I think that superheroes are so over the top, and everything is so heightened, and the metaphors are so literalized that I don't think there's a huge amount of difference. Like, I like writing things that are funny, and I think I'm good at it. But Loki is a tortured character, and I'm trying to get as much of that in there as possible, without disrupting the tonal balance. You know, we're making sure that it can kind of be both things. It can be this, you know, big cosmic adventure, and also this sort of introspective thing about, you know, regrets and trying to grow as a person. So the short version is that I've talked to a lot of writers like Chip Zdarsky and Chris Hastings and Jeff Loveness, and Jeff said something particularly memorable about being a comedy writer who moves into comics and then into dramatic comics, is that he just wants to do stuff where Cyclops is crying. He just, like, why won't anyone give him the chance to do his sad Cyclops? And I used to say, you know, I just want to do, I love writing the jokes. I would love to do more Lockjaw, you know, if somebody wants to give me like a Deadpool or like a Squirrel Girl style project, I am very excited to do that. But it's gonna be, you know, injected with real feelings, because connecting to the characters is sort of the entire point. Like, it's the thing that keeps this whole machine going. And in the back of my mind, it's like, I just kind of want to do Daredevil crying on the rooftops. I just want him to look up at the rain, and you can't tell if it's his tears or the rain. And then I was so excited when Chip started doing Daredevil, because, like, this guy gets it. They gave Daredevil the Howard the Duck guy, because comedy is sad.
Yes,
Everyone
right.
knows it. It's not a secret. And it's just, I mean, there's almost all Daredevil runs are good. But boy, do I love this current Daredevil run. And I'm
It's really good.
extremely, extremely open to whatever sad comic book anybody wants to let me write.
Is there a lot of geeking out on the Late Show?
Medium amounts of geeking out, I would say. Everybody's kind of got a beat, you know,
Yeah,
like, there's
yeah.
sports geeking out. There's people there who would probably stop reading the news if they had a choice.
Right, right.
I think by and large everybody there is a news junkie, and, you know, Steven obviously is wears his interests on his sleeves. So it'll be really fun when the movies come out, especially. We occasionally have opportunity to work with the actors, and one thing that I got to participate in was a sort of a group interview with the Avengers cast after Endgame,
Oh
where
man.
Yeah, I saw that's the you
It's
asked
sort
about
of a tough.
Garjo,
Yes.
right?
Oh, God, what was Mark Ruffalo, Joe? Something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was really fun. It's on YouTube and the show's website and social media as well. So I think that because of the real life hobbies of the host, that stuff is always available to writers like me who are interested in, you know, leaping on those opportunities when they become available.
I mean, Stevens literally had the Captain America shield on his sleeve, you know?
Yeah. That's and the one that's on the set is Mark Grunwald's shield
Oh, wow.
that he had made and was gifted to the Colbert Report by Joe Quesada.
Yes, I remember that episode. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
So
another really
cool.
fun one to go back and find. So yeah, there's definitely geeking out, but it's just because we're all passionate people. Like, we all care about the things that we care about, and I think that one of the things that gets you a job like this is a lot of a strong point of view, like, because that leads to a strong comedic point of view, and also a lot of passion and attention to detail and minutiae, because so much of the job is understanding something and then explaining it to somebody else in a relatable and, you know, in the case of the talk show, a comedic way.
So what has been your proudest moment in comics?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I'm very aware of the opportunities, because it's possible that they could go away. So whenever I see a window to do something a little bit memorable, I tried to jump on it. So the first paid comics work I had was a parody of the Charles Atlas bodybuilding ads.
Oh, wow.
And it was for Bloodshot's number 25. It had some fake ads in it, some comedy ads. And the first line of dialogue in that, and therefore like the first line of comics dialogue I got paid for, was I think it's, "Hey, Wimp Squeak wants to get punched." And I think a lot of this is retroactive justification, but I think about that a lot, because it's like, it's kind of cool that like my first comic book gig was this very meta thing about like the ads that were in comic books and like the, you know, and like a nerdy guy and like bullying and like how it was trying to synthesize like all my feelings that are wrapped up into this. I get very, very self-mythologizing about it in a pretentious and regrettable way. But I'd say that's up there, just getting to do it and having the first thing I did be kind of this self-aware celebration of comics. And then the other big one is getting to write for Marvel for the first time. Because I grew up predominantly reading Marvel comics, although, you know, I filled in all of the blanks, obviously, and read everything now. That was what got me into it. Okay, no, I'll pick my proudest moment. It's in Lockjaw. It's in Lockjaw number one. He drinks milk out of a bucket. That is the milk bucket that Jack Kirby drew in Lockjaw's first appearance.
Oh wow!
Oh, I like it. A nice choice.
It took a little bit of thinking out loud, but I got there. My proudest comics moment is that I brought back Lockjaw drinking milk, which, you know, Reed Richards, for whatever reason, gave Lockjaw a big bucket of milk. Like, even at the time, I don't think that's what the dog drank, but he gave Lockjaw a big bucket of milk. And Jack Kirby, being Jack Kirby, draws all, it's bright green, and he draws all these dials and like circles. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because if Reed Richards has a bucket, it's not like a regular bucket, you know? It's some kind of negative zone, you know, interdimensional bucket. So yeah, for Lockjaw number one, we have Karnak making cereal in the kitchen, and then he pours milk into this stupid green bucket that the Inhumans apparently just held on to for 60 years.
There's a whole story there about what that bucket's all about.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think at the time I tweeted that it was my favorite Jack Kirby character.
Nice.
I think it was like Dr. Doom and Ben Grimm and then that bucket.
You know your Marvel history, you know your Marvel characters. Talking about politics and news, if you could have any Marvel Universe character join the 2020 election, who would it be? And it can't be the milk bucket.
Right. Okay. I was going to say Black Panther, but he wasn't born in the U.S.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I think because I just thought of like, well, who's the most competent? Oh, you know what would be great is the Invisible Woman. I think there'd be some sort of like thematic stuff there about, you know, being a woman in politics and being a woman in society. But she's, I think she's got the experience and the intelligence and the fortitude. I'm a big Sue Storm fan. I think Reed would be a little too detached. You know, he gets a little in his own head. I think Sue is a pragmatist. I'd vote, then the buttons could have little blue fours on them too, the political buttons. So that'd be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
I like it.
I could see a scandal where Reed gives a dog some milk and it's a whole. Oh, why did he do that? He's so out of touch.
That's real sick. Well, it's all on YouTube now. You know, you can't do that stuff anymore.
Of course, I'm thinking about Mark Waid's Invisible Woman series right now and how she's like, we're just finding out she was a secret spy for Nick Fury for all those years. That might get out and get her in trouble.
I don't know. These days, that sounds like more service to your country.
That's true.
I'm all for it. She probably killed Bin Laden.
Oh my God! Yes, there you go. That's their platform. I killed Bin Laden. I was there. Okay, so that's the end of our interview portion. We wanted to move on to our next segment, which is Super Fight. It's a game by Skybound. It's a card game, and basically we randomly generate a DC character and randomly generate a Marvel Comics character, and then we have them fight. Are you guys ready?
I'm very ready. I'm very excited about this.
All right, so I'm gonna randomly generate a Marvel character. And I've got Cyclops.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Oh, great start.
And then for DC, we have Batgirl.
Fascinating.
And I'm gonna pull a card. All right, so who is best at escaping a temple full of booby traps after stealing a sacred idol? It's very specific. Most of these are silly, like best cheerleader. All right, so.
That is really tough.
I feel like in the Pride of the X-Men start, isn't Cyclops like kind of running around a temple?
Right, that's the thing. I can picture Cyclops doing this kind of thing a lot. I mean, to take it back to X-Men video games, there's always something where you gotta go into an apocalypse temple.
Mm-hmm.
Always, always, always.
I feel like Batgirl would be better at dodging like traps and stuff, though.
That's the thing. I think that that's more her, even though Cyclops might have more specific experience with this element of actual ancient temples, Batgirl's, all of her training is death trap oriented, right? It's all like...
Right.
It's like escapes and leaping.
But she has a cape. The cape's going to just pin her down, maybe.
She does have a cape.
Are they fighting each other, Dave? Like, are they competing?
I mean, we are trying to figure out who would be better at this very specific scenario.
You can imagine it like the Nickelodeon Legends of the Hidden Temple, where they're both literally doing this.
Right.
And it's a race.
I'm thinking that if this is, depending on what era of Cyclops we're talking about, if it's post Jean's death, I'm wondering if seeing Batgirl with her red hair will make him think of Dean and freeze in his tracks.
So that ridiculous.
That is very much the kind of thing that he does. I like Cyclops a lot. I'm not one of the people on the internet who talks crap about Cyclops, but if there's anything he does reliably, it's freeze up at the memory of Jean Grey. I think for all the reasons we just said out loud, I have to give this one to Batgirl. I think it's a narrow edge, but I see her like rolling more, like kind of ducking and rolling and leaping with a thing under her arm. I think that Cyclops would be inclined to use his force beam in a way that would just make things worse. That would just cause more destruction.
Oh,
I
think yes.
Because you're looking at somebody whose primary tool, the thing that is their instinctive go-to, is probably a deficit in this situation. So I'm going to give it to the person who does not have this and who has been trained sort of to purely defensively when necessary. And I think she's smaller. I think there might be like crawling through like holes and stuff.
I can see Cyclops caving in the temple on himself and Batgirl rescuing him, dragging him out of there.
And then he's like a little bit like loopy and he's like, Jean!
Yeah, you get that, the blurry vision. Yeah. You know, the hallucination for 1 second.
He's very good at strategy, right? But like, if he doesn't know the lay of the land, how is he going to get out?
Yeah, he's a before guy, not a during guy. That's what Wolverine is for.
That's well said.
Wolverine gets him out of there.
All right, that's it. I think we've all decided yes. Oh, I don't know about Chris, but I think I'm going to side with you.
I'll give
it
to Batgirl.
Yeah, I think Batgirl would be the one that comes out of there alive with the sacred idol, I might add. So one more segment, Daniel. It's called Off Topic Top Shelf. This is where we give you a chance to tell the world about something you're really into that's not comics related.
Oh, man. Oh, I wish I'd thought about this harder. Am I doing anything that isn't work right now? Okay, I'm going to give it to a show that just wrapped up its most recent season. I think it's third season, and that is Snowfall on the FX network, which is prestige television if any way you cut it, but I never hear anybody talking about it. And it is a ensemble period drama about the rise of crack in LA in the 80s and how the US government was involved and all of the different, in the case of this show, the different factions that sort of cooperate and or go to war with each other, like the sort of the Latin gangs and the people bringing stuff up from Colombia across the border, and the CIA agent who's kind of a crappy person and in way over his head, recruiting this really young, ambitious dealer who kind of becomes a kingpin, like a 19-year-old Walter White,
Oh, geez.
in the early days of crack, where you really like him, but his intelligence and ambition is manifesting in a really violent and dangerous way. It's great. It's like Game of Thrones, but in LA and true, or based on things that are true.
Right.
So yeah, it's one of our favorite shows around here, and I never, even on media internet, I never hear anybody talking about it. But it's fantastic, and it's almost certainly going to have a season 4. So now would be a great time to catch up because it just went on break.
Nice pick. I need to catch up on this now. Chris, have you watched the show?
I haven't heard of it until now, so yeah, I'll check it out.
That's the thing
Wow.
that gets me. It's not that people haven't seen it, they haven't heard of it.
Yeah. Maybe it's because of FX. It's kind of like off the beaten path a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
So that's the end of our show. Thank you so much for being on the show. And everybody, you should be picking up Loki. Is there anything else that we should be keying into that you're into right now or you're working on right now?
Let's see. Loki is the only thing that I have announced. I've got some fun stuff in the pipeline that I'm excited about.
Ooh.
And then next year, I have a children's book coming out that I would love for people to watch for, called Princess Dinosaur.
Princess Dinosaur.
With illustrations by my collaborator Ashley Quach, and it's for toddlers. It's for kids who see themselves as fairy princesses 1 minute, and utterly destructive agents of chaos the next minute. So it's about an actual dinosaur who is also an actual princess, and the way that
Oh.
That little kids can contain multitudes, and you don't necessarily have to have a big backlash or backlash to the backlash when it comes to them falling in love with gender stereotypes, because they are multifaceted, and they kids are big enough boxes to have a lot of personality.
Very cool. We should check that out. And I mean, you also this is a you worked with her on Santa's Husband, right?
Yeah, this is our follow-up.
Very
So
cool.
it's another message book. Hopefully this one does not get us on Fox News.
Oh,
I think it's going to be
jeez.
a little less controversial, but still hopefully have a good message about kids sort of. It was somewhat inspired by parents who were trying to make sure that they had these kind of gender neutral households, so that their daughters knew that they could be scientists and presidents and cowboys, but they'd go to school or they'd go to a birthday party or something, and everything would become princesses overnight. And then other parents see that and they blame those parents for the princess phenomenon as though it's their fault or as though it's inherently negative. So we just wanted to make something that kind of synthesized everything that kids are and the phases that they go through and the way you can oscillate wildly between them.
And you're also going to be at New York Comic Con in a few weeks, right?
Yes, I will be at Artist Alley A28 with my good friend and sometimes collaborator Elliot Rahal. So please come say hi. I will sign all of your Lokis. Even if it's an iPad, I'll sign the silver one,
Just
and
not
we'll get it
permanent
done.
ink.
Oh, we'll see. I don't know. It's worth more. It's
We'll
worth
get
the price.
crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be at a New York Comic Con too, Daniel. So I'll swing by there, and maybe we
You
can get you
bet.
into our X-Men Monday edition. I know you talked a lot about X-Men this week, but love to talk more.
I have never written an X-Man. I would love to talk about X-Men.
Great.
All right, thanks, Daniel. And if you like the show, please like, please subscribe, and please review. And we will be back next Sunday. Thank you.